You're in tune with What It Is on WNCW. I'm Joe Kendrick, joined by Zach Sitter, Bob Hinkle, and Fred Mills. Today, we're talking up ticket prices and the recent sort of implosion of all of the expensive ticket prices that have been building up over the years. And, you know, back in the day, as they like to say, you could go see a concert for a fraction of what it costs now. In the 70s, you could go see big name acts for $3, $4, $5, $6, $10, what have you. It started to really build its way up from that in the 80s in some of the big concert arenas. It's starting to get into the $20 range. And then suddenly by the 90s, it was, I think, the Rolling Stones that really set the precedent for the $100 ticket. All of that is falling back in on itself. And that's what we're talking about today on What It Is.
You know, it's interesting, guys. Exactly 2 years ago, I think Joe and Jeff Eason and I were sitting here talking about how healthy the touring industry is and how in the face of declining CD sales that this was now the prime source of revenue for artists. Then a year ago, we took a more cautionary note, and I think one of the conversations we may have had revolved around how with the tanking economy and even high gas prices, how our artists were adapting to this, maybe not touring as widely, being a little bit more selective with their bookings, knowing that consumers were voting with their wallets, trying to give more value in shows in different ways. And so here we are, folks. Them chickens done come home to roost.
Indeed.
Because, as you say, it's imploding. All observers say this is the worst concert season ever, and consumers are indeed voting with their wallets. Just recently, Lilith Fair had to cancel about a third of that tour. Just a couple of days ago, prior to this taping, the American Idol tour canceled the last 2 weeks. Now, say what you will about American Idol tour, that's just another symptom of what's going on, because you've got everybody from Jonas Brothers, Eagles, Christina Aguilera, Rihanna, Limp Bizkit, canceling tours or canceling big chunks of tours. And it's because people, as they sang, went in network, people are mad as hell, and they just decide they're not going to take anymore. Right.
Well, let's talk for a second about how to get this way. How do we get into a situation where where I'm going to have to sell my house to go, to take my children to a concert? They're old, by the way, my children. I'm even older. But to me, the ticket companies, the big ticket companies, who shall remain nameless, but we know who they are the new big record companies as they existed 25 years ago in the old model of the record business, which means that you've got a situation where there are some executives and they're getting, their instinct is to go get the most money no matter what and to get it now and not to worry too much about the future. So some of those folks are even the same folks who are now involved in the ticket companies. And they saw that as the impact of records lessened over the beginning somewhere in the 80s and going through the 90s, and it's kept on going until now. As it lessened, then the thing that was going to make artists develop and happen and be able to grow careers was playing live. It was the next most logical thing, is how to reach the most people. So they, the big ticket companies, sort of began to try to see how they could extract the most money from that market. And then on the other end of things, of late, we've had this incredible recession where there's a whole lot less disposable income than there used to be. It should have been a kind of a no-brainer on the part of the ticket people to begin to figure out that people just don't have the money to spend, don't want to spend it, so we have to do something to make it a little more affordable. But they didn't do that. They kept raising the ticket prices. So at some point, the line of what people are willing to pay and the line of what the folks, the ticket companies wanted to charge crossed, and it's been diminishing returns ever since.
Well, there's a subtext to what you're saying there, too. You're right. There's a lot of the same players from the old-school record industry in the ticketing industry right now, and that subtext is arrogance. They brought that inbuilt arrogance with them, and they just stopped considering who they're trying to serve. They think they're serving their artists and their bottom line, but they forget that they've got to get some people to actually open up their wallets before they can address that bottom line.
Well, I'm wondering, too, how much of this is really at the larger end of the spectrum and whether smaller clubs that you know may deal more directly with the labels and the tour agents and so on, and not so much with you know Ticketmaster and whatnot, you know, whether they're feeling the same pinch that, you know, the big stadium shows are feeling, you know, the kinds of places where the $10, $12, maybe $15, $20 for a big act is still pretty typical.
I think Bob knows a little bit about feeling the
just
pinch.
Just a shade, yes. And running one of those kind of smaller 300-person venues in the metropolis city of Black Mountain, I can tell you that, yes, and from the other venues that I know something about, the pinch is being felt there, too. And it's interesting because you'd think that there'd be a trickle-down of some sort. That if you're an act that sort of fallen away from being able to have a higher ticket that you'd want to, and you were that act, you'd want to be able to play for a lower ticket price and go to a smaller place. Hasn't really worked out that way quite as straightforward as you imagine it would. Yeah, we're feeling it. We're feeling the pinch too. I mean, my real booking philosophy has as much to do with finding the artists that are in our region and building them at my place so that they get an audience for me and my club. I care a whole lot more about that than I do talking to an agent or somebody who's going to bring somebody in from outside who's passing through.
All right, well, tell me this. I'm curious. When you're talking to these people, does a promoter or agent say, okay, I'll give you this act and this is the guarantee we need? Do you have to sometimes come back and say, no, I can't meet that guarantee. How about this? Is there any back and forth? Or are they conveying the same arrogance that we're talking about? Are they getting the message?
Yeah, well, I think the real answer is it depends on the agent. If you're an agent who represents an act that you and your agent head, and agents do have heads, feel is an act that should, you know, be able to retain their higher guarantee, then that's a short negotiation, mm-hmm. you know. And I don't get to have that act. There are a few, and they tend to be the agents who represent the sort of the one level down from that act, who are willing to talk with you and negotiate with you. And every once in a while you can get a big agent who's got an act coming through, desperately needs to fill a night, and only then will they begin to talk about a lesser guarantee.
Well, also part of this whole phenomenon of the ticket prices ballooning, and now we see that balloon start to burst, some of that, those excessive ticket prices have to have a kind of a chilling effect on the entire concert-going public, in that people just balk at a point from the whole experience. And what you want to do is you want to have people in the habit of going out and seeing live music. And if you discourage them from that for even a short amount of period of time, then by and large, you have just great big repercussions on down the road. And I think we have only just barely begun to see what those repercussions are starting to be.
Oh, that's a great point, because anybody that... And here I'm going to talk specifically about, say, the larger shows, the amphitheater shows, the arena shows, where you go through the internet ticketing agency, who shall remain nameless because they're a dark, evil force out there. But you know, so you order up your tickets, bam, you know, that's the price, say $35. You know, go to checkout, bam, oops, there's a service charge, oops, there's a facility charge, oops, there's another charge, you know, if you want to have it mailed to you. So that $35 is now $50. So then you go to the arena. Oops, there's another $8 to park. So we're at $58.
Heaven forbid you should eat.
Well, there's another $20. And if you're an imbiber, there's another $20 too, because those beers ain't cheap in the arena. You know, it's no wonder people smuggle booze in these places. You know, you're going to come out one ticket, and your experience is going to come out costing you $75 or more. And that's ridiculous. And people are tired of getting, you know, like I said, bam, bam, bam. It's like, you know, thank you, church lady. Can I have another?
But I'm wondering, though, if the crash that we're seeing, or at least the downturn in live attendance and ticket sales in general, even at the lower end of the cost and capacity spectrum, I mean, if that's a widespread phenomenon, it seems difficult to point to a single cause for why people are not You know, in other words, the reasons why people are not paying, willing to pay 50, 60, 75 bucks to see a big arena show, are they actually the same reasons that are keeping people at home instead of paying 8 or 10 bucks to see a show at a smaller club? And I'm wondering, I mean, it seems like there's an analogy that could be made here to the real estate bubble, where, you know, it's these second homes that are mostly going into foreclosure. But I can't quite hold that analogy together. But it seems interesting that we have this movement at both ends of the spectrum, and that there hasn't, in my experience, been that same kind of inflation at the smaller clubs. You know, I mean, I'm paying maybe $10 or $12, whereas 10 years ago I might have been paying $7 or $8, but that to me doesn't feel like a big pinch.
You know, the housing bubble analogy has actually been floated a couple of times, and I think at the high end scale of concert going, that does apply. I think that probably is exactly what we're seeing. On the lower end, I know that without naming any names, there are a couple of local venues in Asheville that are don't necessarily have the low end shows. Some of their shows tend to be, you know, kind of mid level, but they're having to adopt a few of the same ticketing strategies. Word has gone out that they're offering free tickets and maybe even some 2-for-1 deals, just because they need to get butts in seats. And this has been going on all summer long. This is actually what has caused a lot of the media attention. Is, for example, going back to Lilith Fair, the organizers realized they were in trouble early on, so they started offering some discounted ticket packages to people, angering folks that had bought tickets at the very outset. And in turn, that's created this walk-up mentality. If people say, wait a minute, why should I pay $35 for my ticket? Mm-hmm. Now, if they're going to offer a 2-for-1 deal in 3 or 4 weeks, so they'll wait. Well, if they wait, then they don't get the money in, then they cancel the tour because there's no ticket sales. So it's a kind of a beast feeding on itself. And this has got to trickle down a little bit to the lower levels, I think.
There's another point, which is a sort of slightly different, but Fred and I talked at one point some weeks ago about how when you go to a show, you should feel good about where you are. There should be something about the place that, if it's not your second home, it should be, you know, you should feel like the management of the place and the people putting on the show are kind of there for you, not that you're there for them. And that doesn't seem to be happening very much, particularly in the larger venues. There's a way for Madison Square Garden, for heaven's sake, to feel like a good place. And I've been there and, you know, and seen it happen. But, you know, I feel like I'm walking into IBM and walking out of AT&T, you know, whenever I go to a big show these days, and I don't feel comfortable.
Or walking away from an ATM.
Yeah, right.
Here's another analogy for you. And you look at any ecology, any sort of biosystem, whatever you call it, and you get these large predators and herbivores, and there's a tipping point where they get too large. And if they start dying out, it affects the entire ecosystem. And I think that's a little bit of what has happened here is we're losing the woolly mammoth.
That's a good point. And I know I have not seen a big change in club ticket prices. I think they've remained fairly stable depending on the act that's coming through. If it's at a 900 to 1,000 seater, you might be paying as much as $20 for a ticket. If it's, you know, for a 300 to 500 seater, $10. You know, I'm just throwing out figures, and those seem to have remained stable. But some of those acts that are coming through may actually be having to adjust their horizons. Where that act coming through to the 1,000 seater, 2 years ago, they might have been doing a 2,500 seat theater. I remember a year or so ago, when the Indigo Girls canceled their show at Thomas Wolfe Auditorium in Asheville, and everybody knew it was because there was poor ticket sales. Sure enough, later that year, the event was rescheduled and they held it at the Orange Peel. So that's that ecosystem phenomenon that's going on. If it's ailing in the upper tiers, eventually it just starts kind of moving down the tiers to where you finally got, you know, these poor schmucks at the bottom that they can't even get a booking, so they just go sit up on Battery Street with their guitar case open.
leave it to Joe and Fred to take a situation and make it apply to archaeology.
Well, now, tell me, guys, you know, we're griping. What are the solutions? As you said, Bob, clubs do develop loyalty among their clientele if they feel like this is a home away from home.
Right.
And if they're treated properly, from the actual ticket price to just the way the staff treats them, and artists like that too. Artists are loyal too, and so there's a lot of different ways to get people to come out if they know what they're going to get. But other times people don't know what they're going to get. They are just attracted by the name itself, and they can still be scared away if the ticket price is too high.
People want access. People love those meet and greets after the show. They love that sort of genuine hospitality.
Right.
Anywhere.
And I think, you know, seeing a certain act in a certain venue can often, you know, really create a synergy that's exciting for fans. You know, in Boston, it always used to be the Middle East was, and I think actually it still is kind of the go-to venue for, you know, again, the smaller, not the stadium size shows, but, you know, I remember seeing the John Spencer Blues Explosion at the Middle East, and it was, you know, an amazing show, partly because you would see people there that, I mean, it was a great show to begin with, but you'd see people there that you'd seen at other shows. It's kind of a familiar surrounding, you know, they knew how to run a sound system. I mean, even those little details. So I think that, you know, building for venues, building a kind of brand loyalty, although I hate that phrase, but, and that, you know, has to do with a smart booking strategy too. I mean, there are a lot of artists that it wouldn't have made sense to book at that venue, either because, you know, that's not where the neighborhood that the fans of that artist would be likely to go to, or just because, again, there is a kind of association that people have with a certain venue. And seeing a band that's in a different kind of genre or aesthetic might not be as exciting to them, whereas if they can kind of see, you know, I guess think of it as like the right frame for the picture. And I think that's a strategy that's, you know, not a new one, but that would still serve venues well.
Well, it's hard, too, if the name of your venue is Bojangles Fried Biscuit Amphitheater.
That's very true.
And it's just really hard.
All the good times.
Yeah. I mean, there's some branding going on there, but I don't know how much loyalty is being engendered.
Yeah.
But, yeah, you're right. People want a memorable experience, and artists are mindful of this, too. I never forget seeing Alejandro Escovedo up at the Orange Peel one night, and he came out afterwards to stand at the merch table and sign autographs and stand for pictures. He didn't have to do that. I mean, larger artists are charging VIP premium passes for that, you know, for the pre-show meet and greet, where instead of paying $35, pay $350, you know, for some munchies, a free drink, and a handshake with your hero. Well, that's another twist entirely, but my point is that artists, I think, almost have a duty to enhance the concert-going experience. These people are paying to see you play, so there's nothing wrong with coming out after the show to let them tell you that it was the best show they've ever seen, right. Even if you're tired and worn out, you just like to get on the bus. You know, spend that half hour, guys, and you'll be building up some brand loyalty, too.
The national acts that we've brought into our place have, without exception, come to me after a show and after they've had the ability to do this, to sort of interact with the crowd, and said what a great thing it was and how much they enjoyed it and how much, you know, per capita more merch actually they sold for doing it. And you know, our place is set up to where the dressing room is immediately adjacent to the stage. You can see the artist coming from the dressing room to the stage, and you know, there's an escape valve for them if they want to escape. But no one has chose to do that. Everybody really wants to shake hands and get to know the people that were there, and it's worked.
I think that, you know, the paradox in some ways is that most artists, the ones that aren't just completely on the kind of corporate model, I think most artists would actually like, you know, would rather play smaller venues in terms of the atmosphere, the immediacy of the crowd. It even usually sounds better on stage in a smaller space. But, you know, then there's the bottom line, and it's usually hard for a smaller club to, you know, compete if somebody's able to draw to fill, you know, a venue with a couple thousand seats or 10,000 seats. You know, you're not going to be able to pay on that level. But I think there is still a place for even for people that can draw those crowds in the thousands, you know, as long as they're making a, you know, a decent check playing at a small venue. I think, you know, that kind of, you know, I've seen artists do that where they'll do a big stadium tour or, you know, at least theater, amphitheater type tour. And then, you know, they'll play a few small shows as well, you know, usually for the loyalists. And there's not a lot of publicity, but, you know, it's a way of keeping them in touch with
the I've got it. I'll raise my ticket prices.
Yeah, some of this boils down to the two conflicting philosophies of how an artist, how a star should conduct themselves. And on one hand, to be a star, you've got to be put up on a pedestal somewhat. I mean, you remember when Jimmy Carter was walking down towards the inauguration instead of riding the limo, and how aghast so many people were that he was actually you know, such a common man. You know, it was like, oh, and on one hand, it's better to have that access to a lot of people. I mean, you think back to any number of public figures, you know, Richard Petty just spending hours and hours and hours that he didn't have to signing autographs and such. And you've got that camp versus the other camp of, I'm going to charge you to get this autograph. And maybe some of that is starting to shift towards the accessibility model, the philosophy that, hey, I better be grateful for where I am. And, you know, Tiger Woods comes back and figures out that he really needs all of his fans mm-hmm. to like him again. Mm-hmm. So he's going to be a little bit more accessible.
So you could look at it as what you're calling the accessibility model could also be looked at as a value model, because that person who is, you know, getting close to Jimmy Carter or seeing that act that they love and they love to go see up close and shaking their hand and stuff is creating more value for that evening for that person.
And that term value gets right at the heart of what we're talking about, because people obviously have been deciding specifically about these big shows. The value is not there. They reach the tipping point and they say, beyond here, I can't go any farther. And it's not a value for me when I factor in that all those fees and concession charges and the babysitter fee and the gasoline fee. People just, like I said, they got mad as hell and they're not going to take it anymore. So, well, the wake-up call is already being sent out to promoters and venue operators, but now I think that wake-up call needs to be sent to the artist too, is give your fans some value. It's going to be different for each artist. I mean, not Bruce Springsteen can't necessarily come out to the merch table after a show, but he might find a midway point that would mm-hmm. make a lot of people happy.
Sure.
Maybe, hey, he could tag along with Alejandro Escovedo and see how it's done, you know.
There's also the Stones. Every time before a tour, they would always play, whether it was in Toronto or
do a little club
just
show.
Outside Boston, yeah. They go do a club. Yeah. And they do it more than one night, usually.
What do you think? Email us whatitis at wncw.org. Your thoughts on ticket price, on accessibility of musicians, of stardom in general. For WNCW, I'm Joe Kendrick, joined by Zach Sitter, Fred Mills, and Bob Hinkle. Until next time.